entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
But sure enough is good Sunday morning. Welcome in. It's the best of Downtown. April number 22. Wow. Where did that month go, huh? Rich Kimble here, along with Carrie Haskell. We're brought to you this morning and every weekday afternoon by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program are heard on the G&M Family Market phone line. They're on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the program this morning, some terrific conversations. A couple of authors will visit with us and look back to the 1960s. Mark Kurlansky, author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. John Florio, the co-author of One Nation Under Baseball. And we also visit with our friend David Roth of Deadspin. All coming up over the course of the next 59 minutes or so here on Z62 Retro Radio. Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell doing what we do on a Sunday morning. And of course, good weather finally here and into the week. Why? Why, Carrie? You can thank me because my school vacation is over, so you can count on beautiful days ahead.
That's the way it always works.
Yes.
And I thank you because I don't have school.
No, and the good news is I didn't really feel compelled to do any yard work over the last week or so, so that's good. You know, now it's out there, but hey, it's back to the grind of all those jobs, so get the boy out there with a rake in his hand.
Tell him it's play. He'll believe it.
He's only four, but I think he knows better than that. Anyway, good stuff here this morning. We're working on some specials for this summer. One of them will look back at the incredible year of 1968 that saw so much happen, so much change in the world, in America, in sports, in politics, in music, you name it. And so we'll have a number of guests on between now and then to talk about that year. One of them wrote an entire book on the year, and it's a terrific one, called 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. Here's our conversation from last week with author Mark Kurlansky. Well, let's talk about 1968 for a year that ended up being so turbulent in so many ways. As you write in the book, it started very peacefully.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the problem with history is, you know, that books have a beginning and an end, but history just kind of flows.
Mm.
So, you know, years are kind of an arbitrary thing. So I start with January 1st and end with December 31st. And, you know, January started off relatively peacefully, but I would have to say that 1967 was not that peaceful a year. Nor was 1969. You know, 1968 was the year that stood out with so many events, but it's not like it was unexpected that there would be troubles in 1968 because there were troubles in 1967.
Right. Yeah. Forces were already percolating to turn it into such a challenging year. And at least from the American perspective, that was brought into focus with the Tet Offensive of late January. And is that something, first of all, that our military had any hint was coming?
Apparently not. They seem to have been taken completely by surprise. In fact, it took a long time for the military to understand what happened because it didn't make any sense. It was basically a suicidal attack on the part of the Viet Cong. And it was hard to understand why they would do such a thing. But they did it for exactly what happened. I mean, it's the impact that it had on the American public. It really was kind of the end of the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong was destroyed by Tet and its aftermath. But its impact had, you know, it just really stepped up the resistance to the war.
Yeah, an absolute military failure, but in terms of changing American public opinion, and it was, of course, students who were already protesting in the streets, but even respected leaders, perhaps none more than Walter Cronkite, who did the special not long after his visit to Vietnam and essentially said that The only honorable way was for us to get out.
Yeah, which was, I talked to Cronkite about this. You know, it was a difficult thing for him to do because, you know, he was schooled in the neutral school of journalism. But it just seemed so overwhelming that Americans weren't getting the truth about what was happening. And, you know, Tet, yes, it was a military defeat, but, you know, it's the nature of television. Cronkite was a television guy, you know. Didn't look like a defeat on television, nor did almost anything else going on there. It was the first war to be covered this way by television, and it didn't play very well. In fact, you know, war really isn't covered that way anymore because there's no way for television to make it look good.
You were involved in the protests during the Vietnam War, and we've seen what young people can do. Are there any parallels, because people try to make them, between student activists of the 1960s and the young people involved in the March for Our Lives these days?
Yeah, there is a parallel. I mean, the young people for some time were trying to, they had this interest in the 60s. I would go around to schools and talk to students, for example, during the Iraq War, which is kind of the time frame that my book on 68 came out. And, you know, young people would say, you know, what can we do? And they wanted to understand what we had done so that they could do it. In time, they really moved beyond the idea of asking us, you know, and are just doing it on their own. But, you know, what they got out of the 60s is that young people can do it.
Was Lyndon Johnson in some way perhaps a victim himself of the Tet Offensive and that changing public opinion? Or had that already begun before that?
Well, in Johnson's mind, it certainly had. I mean, if you know, go back and look at tapes and letters and things, Johnson was always aware of the fact that this was politically a really bad thing, and he just didn't know how to get out of it. And, you know, he had conversations with politicians that he was close to about, you know, this is just a disaster, and how can we get out of it? But he was caught up in the idea that, you know, it would be politically unacceptable to just, you know, in his mind, back down from a war. And also this notion that they used to call the domino theory, that, you know, you let one country fall to communism and all the others will follow, you know, which history showed to be complete nonsense.
We're talking with Mark Kurlansky, the author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. And the turbulence of that year was certainly not limited to the United States, with all that happened with the Prague Spring and then the Soviet invasion, the Alexander Dubček experience. What was the most significant global event of 1968 from your perspective?
Well, I think you just named it. It was the Prague Spring. I think with the hindsight of history, that was the huge event of 1968 because it was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. If Brezhnev had handled Dubček and the Prague Spring, and then, you know, Dubček was riding a wild thing. You know, it was really the young people. And he was a good communist and a friend of the Soviet Union. And so were a lot of the people, you know, involved in the Prague Spring. And if Brezhnev had been able to see it as a friendly movement, not an enemy of the Soviet Union, history might have been very different. What he did instead was show everyone in the Soviet Union that Moscow would tolerate no dissent whatsoever, which, you know, to young people at the time, it was an uncommunist idea. They were brought up, these people were communists, you know, and they were brought up with the idea of communism. And part of the idea of communism was that you protest and you're always reforming and changing things.
Well, as you point out in the book, too, Dubček was of that generation who saw the Soviet communists as conquering heroes for their work in defeating Hitler.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, is that Czechoslovakia, more than any place else in Eastern Europe, had a closeness and a fondness for the Soviet Union. So, you know, to use the military to invade that country, their closest ally, just really showed the Soviet Union in its worst light. And it never recovered. And Gorbachev, in his memoirs, talked about how, I think it was in 1970, it was a couple of years later, he was stationed in Prague. And he said that he realized that they had lost it, you know, that nobody believed in them anymore.
The assassinations, only 2 months apart, of Martin Luther King Jr. in April, Bobby Kennedy in June, in many ways, was that the death of hope and optimism in America? Because I know, and I was only 10 years old at the time, but I remember family members who just threw their hands in the air as if, you know, we're killing off our best people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was this very strong feeling that I think most of us had. I mean, I was a college student at the time, actually a volunteer for Bobby Kennedy. And in a lot of ways, it seemed like the death of hope. Because, for one thing, I mean, Bobby Kennedy was seen, you know, by me and by people who supported him as hope, as a guy who really was going to stop the war. This was the way out of the whole mess, elect Bobby. And then he shot. And after Kennedy was shot, I mean, Gene McCarthy didn't have really any chance of getting the Democratic nomination. So you got Hubert Humphrey. So you basically had two parties. After everything, you had two candidates running for president, neither of whom opposed the war.
And you had in Nixon someone appealing to, I think we can say in history, in the retrospect that history affords us, that he appealed to the base instincts when he talked about law and order. There was a racist overtone to that. It was an anti-youth message. And then you had the violence in the streets of Chicago, which was the ultimate clash between the old school of Richard Daley and the young people protesting the war.
Yeah, and, you know, it really changed American politics. I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but political conventions used to be really interesting.
Right, well, exactly, yeah.
And they'd go into them, you know, and all the different candidates would have their delegates, and anything could happen. If a candidate did not win on the first ballot, then there was a lot of horse trading for delegates, and who knew who would end up with it. And the Democratic convention in Chicago was the last convention like that.
Right, and that led to the reforms that were enacted in 72, which really took the hands out of a larger group of people and made it a bit more controlled and not as interesting and certainly not as chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, it turned the national conventions into coronations. I mean, you no longer have any doubt who the nominee is going to be when you start the convention. And you have this whole choreographed program of, what is it, 4 days, which is about, you know, launching the candidate. It didn't used to be about launching the candidate. It used to be about picking a candidate.
That race in 68 was so close, and it got closer and closer as Election Day drew. Yeah, it's tough to speculate, but would the world have been, or would America have been, a different place if Hubert Humphrey and Ed Muskie had won that election?
You know, that is an interesting question. Well, I suppose it would have been. You wouldn't have had Watergate. I don't know that the Vietnam War would have turned out any differently. If Kennedy hadn't been shot and he had gotten the nomination, I think the history of America could have been entirely different.
So, Mark, as we look back 50 years, what ways did 1968 fundamentally change America?
It psychologically changed America in a lot of ways. It made a lot of people much more cynical about government. But it also implanted an idea, you know, which goes away but keeps coming back, that you have to stand up for what you believe in. And, you know, after 68, this country was kind of exhausted. And, you know, it just kind of almost went to sleep. And if you look at the Reagan years, and I mean, Reagan was doing extremely harmful things to the poor, and he was killing lots of people in Central America, and he was as devastating to the environment as Donald Trump is. And, you know, there weren't protests. But that idea sat there, you know, for a generation. And, you know, kids now are saying, you know, we need to do what was done in the 60s.
That's Mark Kurlansky here on The Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. More on the 60s coming up a little later with author John Florio. But when we come back, one of our absolute favorites on the show, David Roth of Deadspin. Next, it's Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater presents...
A young, mysterious girl arrives at a rundown grill.
Hartford, Houston,
people who work at the grill have a contest.
Something's cooking up.
People write in explaining why they should own the Spitfire Grill. In the end, something magical happens. Come see the Spitfire Grill, April 26th through May 13th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
Honey, what's all that barking in the neighborhood?
The dogs are saying something.
Let's listen closer.
You know, Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor is more than our home away from home. They're your pet food superstore. My owners have always trusted Green Acres Kennel Shop for the best price and selection. They carry a large variety of Nutrisource pet foods formulated with the best ingredients and made with integrity. Oh, they even have a rewards program. I save my owners money by earning points for every purchase.
We interrupt this message to bring you the cats of the neighborhood.
Meow. It's not all about the dogs around here. Don't forget your feline friends.
Green Acres Kennel Shop is my parents' pet food headquarters. They buy me the best brands of dry and canned choices.
Well, dear, the dogs and cats around here know best. Time to make Green Acres Kennel Shop our new pet food store.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, Union Street, Bangor. Online at greenacreskennel.com.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
We're back, best of downtown on your Sunday morning. Brought to you by Cork Motor City Used Vehicle Center. Locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at corkauto.com. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here with you. And one of our favorites on the show anytime he comes on, because you never know where we're going to go in our conversations, David Roth of Deadspin, who joined us on Thursday's show. How's your jaw after making your way through what appeared to be about a box of Double Bubble?
Three pieces, which is, if you do the math, it's actually sextuple Double Bubble. It was terrible. I wasn't sore, but it was, you shouldn't have that much gum in your mouth. I can explain to the listeners what this means, or you could just let them believe that there's a video of me chewing too much gum online.
Well, both are true. All this because, and I, frankly, I was upset. I was disappointed that you didn't remember guys from the Red Sox pennant-winning year of 86 like Rob Woodward and Steve Shag Crawford.
See, I was also upset, mostly because I had too much gum in my mouth. That's the rules of the game that we play in this video series. So every time I don't remember a guy, I got to, pop whatever, 18 ounces of gum into my mouth. I'm surprised I didn't remember Steve Crawford because he actually pitched. But that pack, in my defense, was just a bunch of random mustachioed guys. Like, you have no proof that Jackie Gutierrez is a real baseball player, and neither do I.
I was worried for you before I watched the video and read the summary and saw what the concept was. I was worried that the gum you had to put in your mouth would be the old gum that came in the pack of baseball cards.
So I've done that, too. I'm an idiot, as you know. and I think that, obviously I prove that every day. I'm proving it right now. But I did, in one of those packs, the gum came out, and it was contiguous, so it looked more or less okay. And I did briefly put it in my mouth, and it was, I guess I've never really chewed on drywall. I don't want to make that comparison, not knowing for sure that that's what it was like. But it broke apart. It was like the shatterproof glass that they put in the windshield. Obviously, no one needs to be told this because everyone that listens to the show is significantly smarter than me, but don't put a 30-year-old gum in your mouth. It's not smart.
The other thing you did that may have endangered your health is you watched this bizarre pro-Trump ad that sprouted up in the middle of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that one was really when watching sports kind of feels like work. I was not watching the game. It was the Minnesota Wild Winnipeg Jets game from a couple nights ago. It was on CNBC, and people started messaging me on Twitter asking if I'd seen the thing. There's no polite way to tell somebody that you weren't watching the Winnipeg Jets game, and that you're maybe judging them for watching it themselves. But I found the ad, and it was weird. It definitely the fun sort of story to write, because I was prepared to write a kind of like, look at this dumb thing blog. And the more I followed it, it's sort of the tip of an iceberg of just like sort of cheesy institutionalized grift that happens sort of out at the very edges of what, is allowed in campaign finance law with PACs and stuff. It just happened to be that their dumb ad ran during a hockey game normal people were watching instead of on CNBC at night when no one is watching.
And I loved I loved your comments on Jim Cramer as well.
I was maybe a little hard on Jim Cramer, but the image that I had of him was just him constantly acting like that and like romping around the studio yelling and mashing buttons, and then they just turn the camera on for 30 minutes every day and capture it, but he's just going the rest of the time too. But I will say that I have in my, there's no reason for me to have ever watched it. I'm not what you would call a serious investor in the stock market, which is to say that I'm not an investor in the stock market. But I kind of think he's good TV, just in the same way that I really enjoyed Peter Finch's performance in Network.
That's so funny you said that, because I, as you were talking about him, all I kept thinking was, yeah, it would have fit right in 1976 and their vision of the future.
Yeah, it. I mean, it's kind of, that's, I think, the thing. I haven't rewatched Network in some years, but that was, you know, the most apocalyptic satire of the media future imaginable, 40-odd years ago. And at this point, like, Kramer would be a little, like, he'd be one of the more understated characters. Like, he'd slot in somewhere below Peter Finch and above Ned Beatty, I would say.
Right, he would be on right before Sybil the Soothsayer.
Yeah, right, which is, you know, I guess, can't say that anybody built this world but us, but it is really, it's remarkable stuff, all the things.
So, now, what, as a viewer of fine television programming and commercials, what's more bizarre in its own way, the pro-Trump ad or the NRA ads that did just take anger to a whole new level?
Those are fascinating to me because they don't even have anything to do with guns, really, at this point. The ones, most of these, I think, function online. They're each exactly 60 seconds. And they may very well be on television, too. I don't, you know what channels they would be on, but they're not on the ones that I'm watching. Like, they don't, you don't see them much during the NBA playoffs, I'll say. But they're baffling to me because it's just some person. Some of them are Dana Loesch or whatever, are more recognizable than others, but some of them are just these kind of interchangeable dudes in t-shirts trembling with rage talking about the media and their lies. And it just doesn't seem like a winning thing to me. Like, somebody that you wouldn't make eye contact with at like a Dunkin' Donuts just bawling you out for 60 seconds about guns, or not even about guns, like just about how, you know, they make the juice too strong these days and the traffic lights take too long or whatever. It's confusing to me.
I follow, we're talking with David Roth of Deadspin here on Downtown. I follow Sean Hannity on Twitter, in the same way that I will glance at National Enquirer when I'm going through the checkout line. It's sort of that same thing. I never looked too closely at his profile until somebody drew my attention to it the other night. And his profile picture looks very different than the Sean Hannity that's on TV today. And I have this theory that as he covers up for more misdeeds and wrongdoing, that somehow he's internalizing all of that and it makes his head get bigger.
I think that there's something to that. I mean, we'd have to see the science, but I'd say the eye test, it certainly passes with flying colors. I was startled because I still remember there's like a, you know, an image of him that I you know, like the profile pic that he used for a really long time. And it was just like the picture that you'd see on the back of a thriller, like one of the, like with raised print that you see at the airport or whatever, and it would be called like Sanction of Honor. Like, he looked like one of those guys. And now the author, not the hero, although I think he probably imagines it that way. But yeah, like something happened to him. He does not look well. And, you know, I don't wish him bad health or anything like that, but I also feel like it has to be pretty unhealthy for a body to go on air and eat that much garbage for 60 minutes.
Yeah, I would think so. Absolutely. Yeah, and I don't watch, by the way. I don't want you to think less of me.
Oh, no. I mean, it's a, there's a limit to what anybody's duty is in terms of being an informed citizen.
Although I do turn occasionally. Like, if something goes really, really bad for Trump, I will turn over just to see him doing a story about something nobody else is talking about.
Yeah, that is actually, I was going to say that that's been like the funniest and probably best reason to watch Fox News of late. I remember I forget which revelation it was, because it's like every day there's two new ones. But there was one day, a very bad news day for Trump. I think it was the Michael Cohen arrest or raid.
Yeah, was that the day he was reporting on sex-crazed pandas?
Yes, that was Tucker Carlson.
Tucker, that's right.
But I wonder, I remember seeing the images of it and just being like, there's no way that this is real. You know, Twitter is full of people making funny sort of fake screen grabs. And I went over there and he's just definitely laughing it up about like the sex lives of alpha pandas.
Well, I can't even imagine what led them to that, but it's fascinating to watch. Let's break away from that depressing stuff and talk about the NBA playoffs. So what do you think so far?
Good. I am enjoying it. I'm you know, this is definitely much less depressing. But also, like, I really have been enjoying it. I would say that I'm borderline enjoying it too much in terms of the West Coast games being too interesting and it kind of messing with my actual life, like just going to bed an hour too late or, you know, suddenly realizing that it's 12:25 and you're like really invested in the Utah Jazz. Like I didn't totally miss that sensation, but that said, like, I really enjoyed watching the Jazz last night. I've really enjoyed watching the games just on balance. And there's something really kind of cool about the fact that the Eastern Conference games have been as fun as the Western Conference games. Like, I don't remember the last time that that was the case.
No, we're having a great time too. Watching the Celtics with their two best players done for the year. Somehow, I think they may end up sweeping the series with a Milwaukee team that other than the Greek Freak appears to have no interest in being there.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on that. I'm sort of surprised at how lame the Bucks have looked. Although, you remember they changed coaches this year and it might just be that this guy never quite lost the interim tag or something like that. I can't believe how little they are getting out of the collection of talent that they have right now, but they're young yet and whatever. I had been fascinated to see how good, you know, the Celtics have been when it's the Terry Rozier show and stuff that, you know, was never really supposed to happen. I know that, you know, next year, if you presume a healthy Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, which I think you probably can, that they're going to be very, very good. But I bet that as a fan, just from what I remember of, you know, watching different teams and then also from talking to a lot of Warriors fans, that this is going to be a team that people are going to really very fondly remember because they're overachieving. And next year, you know, there will be no possibility of overachieving. They're a championship contender, you know, like straight up. But in this case, they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be sweeping anybody in the playoffs with the lineup that they're throwing out there most nights. And yet here they are, like halfway home.
Anybody who's a basketball fan should also go read this piece that you recommended folks check out, and I did, by Dave McKenna, about the Washington Wizards.
Oh, I love that one. I edited that, and Dave McKenna is a guy that I've looked up to for many years, and I am excited to, you know, be working with him. He wrote, basically, it was about the Gilbert Arenas, Nick Young, JaVale McGee, Andre Blatch Wizards teams of the last decade, about 10, 11 years ago. And I remember those teams very fondly. One of my first published pieces was about the sort of Gilbert Arenas, you know, what seemed like a revolution at the time. Mostly it was just that he was the best player in the NBA that was also funny, which is not quite the same thing as changing the game forever. But man, what a bunch of knuckleheads. I mean, it was really, just in terms of reading Dave's piece, he's a very entertaining writer, but he just keeps sort of laying it out, like all the different times that Andre Blatch got in trouble for putting his name on like Lap Dance Tuesdays somewhere in Northwest DC. Like, you gotta, you know, at some point, all you can do is tip your cap. That's a lot of suspensions. He must really have liked Lap Dance Tuesdays.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. We're riding the wave with this great start from the Red Sox, 15-2 under new manager Alex Cora, and another new manager taking care of business. How about those first place Mets?
Yeah, I'm so happy you asked. The Red Sox have seemed a lot more for real to me than the Mets did. That's an extremely good team. And seeing them, you know, whatever, no team is going to win 15 out of 17 games all year long, but they look great. With the Mets, I feel like I'm so wary of having too much faith in them in general. I mean, I knew that this was a team that could, if everything worked out right and everybody was healthy, that they could be quite good. But I just, you know, that's an if. I mean, that's like saying that if I abruptly gained a lot of weight and height that I could contribute valuable minutes on the bench for a contending NBA team. Like, all kinds of things could happen theoretically, but I didn't think that it would work. And I don't know how long it will, but I will say that watching a Mets game and expecting things to fall apart and then instead they score three more runs and it's not even a save situation anymore, that feeling is not accessible to me. It was real as recently as 2015, but I had completely blocked it out.
I'm following things the other night in sports, and this moment was developing, and I thought, I don't know what I will do, because if this comes to fruition, I may just stop watching sports, because it will never get better than it could get if Bartolo Colon had completed that perfect game.
Yeah, that was a special one for me. I love watching Bartolo like I love watching no one else. In part, I mean, we had some good times together when he was with the Mets and all, but there's no more terrifying and fascinating tightrope walk than watching him pitch, because those look for all the world like batting practice fastballs, and they really mostly are, you know, by major league standards. He's throwing 82, And yet, like, when it works, it looks like magic. I mean, it's just, like, that was, I mean, it was against the Astros. It was against one of the very best teams in baseball. And he was carving them up without ever seeming, this is the magic of Bartolo, too, is that beyond not seeming to break a sweat, like, it looks like he's playing catch with a child. Like, he's constantly flicking the ball around to himself and kind of, like, wandering off, muttering, but not in an anxious way, like, in a, like, he just remembered something he needs to get at the grocery store on the way home. I loved watching it. It was great. I think he gets more starts. I think he's only really going to, he's only really guaranteed a start on Saturday. And then technically his rotation spot's supposed to go back to Doug Fister.
It's David Roth of Deadspin here on the Best of Downtown. We love the great guests we have on the show. We've always said it's a guest driven show. And we'll prove that even more starting very soon with the debut May 2nd, a week from Wednesday, of Downtown the Podcast. What is that, you ask? It's the show. It's a couple of great interviews from the show. Beyond that, you know, we don't really know. It's a work in progress, but we've had people asking us about it and encouraging us to do it for quite a while. And finally, we got off our collective duffs and decided to crank it out. And so the podcast coming soon. And we're looking at about 30 minutes or so, Carrie, for each episode.
Yeah, it seemed like a good length for, you know, you want to go out and take a walk, take us along with you.
Yeah, it's rake those leaves. It'll be fine. It'll make it'll make it seem like play if you're doing that. So it'll be a couple of interviews. We'll also dig into the archives as well. We've had so many great prior interviews, and a lot of people have said, well, we'd love to hear those. Apparently going to the website was just too much darn work for people. And so now with the podcast, we'll just send them directly to your phone. The podcast will be available in all the usual places, and you can subscribe to it, and doing there it is on your phone, and you don't have to do anything other than push the play button, and you'll hear it. The Downtown Podcast, sponsored by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength, and our friends at Nice Brewing Company. Downtown the Podcast, coming soon. When we come back, we talk 1960s baseball with author John Florio here on the Best of Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Angelo's Pizzeria has locations in both Bangor and in Hamden, and they're your home for the best pizza, homemade pasta, and Italian takeout. Angelo's Pizzeria, located on Hammond Street in Bangor and Main Road South in Hamden, features a menu that also includes seafood, sandwiches, wraps, and salads. That means there's sure to be something for every member of the family. Stop into Angelo's Pizzeria, Hammond Street, Bangor, Main Road South in Hamden.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome, with more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever, capable, built to serve, rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel driver options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport. Hartley'sCountry.com.
Your home should be your sanctuary, the place that keeps you safe and warm in the winter and cool and dry in the summer. The people at Penobscot Home Performance want to make sure your home is safe, healthy, comfortable, and energy efficient. They take a big picture view with practical steps and use their experience to ensure that the space and systems in your house are working better together. Contact them today for a free energy consultation by visiting PenobscotHomePerformance.com.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Back on the Best of Downtown Sunday Morning, Rich Kimball, Gary Haskell here with you on Z62. You need proof the 60s was a strange decade? Well, you've got the Stones and the Beatles and the start of psychedelic rock, and yet this song with cartoon characters somehow managed to go all the way to number one. It was very much a transitional decade in a number of areas of American life, including sports and baseball. And that's the subject of a terrific book written by John Florio and Wheezy Shapiro called One Nation Under Baseball. We had a chance to talk 60s baseball with John earlier this week on Downtown. It was such a crazy, turbulent decade, and those changes reflected or carried on by baseball, and changes in race relations, labor relations, and even changes in the media. And I was fascinated to read about how media coverage of baseball changed during this decade, thanks to that group known affectionately and perhaps derisively by some as the Chipmunks.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when we sat down, when Wheezy and I sat down and started writing this book, it actually started with us looking at Jim Boughton's Ball 4, which really is what I would imagine some of your listeners know. But Boughton's book at the end of the 70s was a real game changer. I mean, no pun intended, but it was telling stories about what was going on in the locker room. It was a real look inside baseball. And at the beginning of the decade, it wasn't like that. You know, you had reporters were kind of building the myth around players like Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and these heroes. And somewhere through the 60s, we said to ourselves, well, what were the things that led up to Boughton? What was the perfect storm, you know, that allowed that book to even be published? Because he had stories in there about the Yankees, you know, looking into windows, peeping Toms on the top of the roof of the Sherman Hotel in Washington, D.C. How did that even get published at the time? And then we started looking at the arc of the 60s and how we went from the myth building to the tearing down of the myth with Boughton. And right in the middle there was a group of sports writers called the Chipmunks. And a lot of those were afternoon guys in the newspapers. You know, the morning guys were reporting the scores of the game. This guy got a base hit, so-and-so crossed the plate. All of a sudden, you had afternoon guys, and they had to fill the papers with something. They started telling stories about the players themselves, what it was like off the field, what they were doing at home. This guy played for his father. This guy was playing for his mother, who was watching him in a hospital room, whatever it happened to be. And that started paving the way, along with a lot of other things in culture and society. But that started paving the way for a book like Boughton's to come. So in those 10 years, you really saw a shift, a seismic shift in the way the game was covered.
And Jim Boughton wasn't the only ball player that was writing about this. I thought the story of Jim Brosnan was fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, Brosnan was really the first. You know, I mentioned that Boughton was the first, and that's not really true. Brosnan, at the beginning of the decade, had written two books about what it was like to be a baseball player. But his, you know, he was taking heat for just saying, after the game, I like to go home and drink a martini, which maybe you could look at as the beginning of it, but was still very innocuous. It was not really what we saw like happening by the end of the decade. And actually, when I spoke about that book, we were thinking of originally our first idea. We were talking about Boughton. We were going to cover the arc from Brosnan to Boughton. You know, that was the first, bang against the door. And then, Ball 4 came along and just was the battering ram that opened it up.
And, of course, baseball right in the forefront of what was going on in the civil rights movement. And it's hard to imagine it even from 50-plus years out, but to think of the fact that the Yankees didn't add a black player until, 56 with Elston Howard, the Red Sox 59 with Pumpsy Green, and that as the book begins and as the decade begins, these players are still dealing with huge levels of segregation, Jim Crow laws, particularly during spring training.
Yeah, that was very interesting to us. When the book came out, younger readers were saying to us, they didn't realize that the game was still so segregated in the 60s. I mean, the idea, the legend is that, I mean, it is true. I shouldn't say legends, but the common belief is that Jackie Robinson integrated the game, and he did by breaking the color barrier. But the teams and the leagues, there was still segregation going on, and Jim Crow laws when they went south. So when they played in spring training down in Florida in the 60s, players who were used to integrate, even some didn't, but some that were living in integrated cities in the north, when they went down south were playing during spring training, they were in a segregated situation. They had no idea to expect it. One of the guys we speak about is Bill White, who was from a more integrated area in Ohio. He went down and realized, wow, Jim Crow laws here in the South are still going on, and they had to deal with that all through spring training. So the book opens up. We see guys like Hank Aaron, Bill White, Bob Gibson. I mean, major stars. Not that it's right for anybody, but major stars being separated from their team after the game, going to have to live in special housing, and a lot of times not being able to find it.
Hi, this is Bruce John. One of the questions, one of the things that Rich just brought up is with the civil rights movement in baseball, it seems to me it was the first sport of all the sports where the political cause of civil rights and an owner and a player all seem to mesh to come together, so that we think of the incident with Curt Flood, his issues, and with Jackie Robinson, all that all being a natural part of a movement. Is that true, or is that really overstating it and sort of saying that maybe society changed?
Well, I think it's a great question. I appreciate it. I think that there's a lot of truth in it. But what we did when we wrote the book was to try to figure out whether baseball was ahead or behind of the curve. And we had a huge board. We had all these little sticky notes up. And we started writing. And this started, this is how it grew from being just about publishing into about a race and all the things that happened in the 60s. We started putting up all the different events, kind of like a timeline, and it felt a little like a push-me, pull-me. It seemed like baseball started out and was pushing things, and then it would kind of stop and then wait, and society would pass it a bit, and then it would catch up and go ahead, and then it would stop, and society would move forward. So in some ways, it's a chicken and egg thing. Was it keeping up with society, or was it pulling society? I think it was a little bit of both. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say a real sea change in labor relations took place. It started, as you point out in the book, with the twin holdouts of Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax. But then what really changed the playing field was the hiring of Marvin Miller, a guy who should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame, who finally in early 68 got not just the first collective bargaining agreement in Major League Baseball, but in pro sports.
Yeah, well, he was not actually the owner's first choice. We speak about that whole negotiation of bringing him in. He was from the Steelworkers Union. He knew unionization. He actually had a tough time convincing the players to vote for him. Many of them voted, but some of them felt that, unions were a dirty word. So he and a lot of it was being fed by the owners telling the players, unionization, it's not something that's really going to help you. So there was a lot of fear that if the players were able to, a lot of it went back to the language of their contract and the reserve clause, where before Marvin Miller came along, players basically were owned by their teams. You know, it was a language that could be interpreted a couple of ways, but the way it was being interpreted was if you played, like back in the day, like let's say Tony Oliva was playing for the Twins, he was going to have to play for the Twins the following year or he wouldn't be in baseball at all. He wasn't able to go from team to team. So when Marvin Miller was explaining to players, you know, we want to challenge that, we want to, you know, players to be able to go from team to team, which is ultimately what Curt Flood, the big, at the end of the decade, what Curt Flood was fighting for. Some players said, well, won't the teams with the money get all the good players? And what Marvin Miller pointed out to them was, well, it's happening now anyway. It happens through trades. It happens through scouting. It happens a lot of different ways. It's not going to change the playing field that much. You know, of course, history has gone on, and we've seen free agency did change the game quite a bit. But Miller had a point. You know, it wasn't like it only started with free agency that the bigger market teams were getting the best players. It was there were other ways they were getting it before that, through recruitment, through scouting. You know, the Kansas City, the A's were in a lot of ways a feeding system for the Yankees. They would bring players up. The Yankees would trade for them and bring them over to New York.
We're looking throughout the spring and summer back at 1968 on this 50th anniversary, and that was a remarkable year in baseball and, of course, in society. And the assassinations, first in April of Martin Luther King Jr., then in June of Bobby Kennedy, impacted baseball, impacted a number of players. But it seems like none were more impacted and affected than Bob Gibson, who took that anger about those assassinations and everything else that was going on and channeled that into one of the greatest seasons any pitcher has ever had.
Somehow, he was able to take that anger and put it into athletic performance. You know, we spoke with Tim McCarver about Gibson, and he said, you know, the amazing thing about 68 was not only did his anger put it make him hyper focused? He said his control was unbelievable. He said, you know, you would think somebody who's that angry would lose their control. He said, but he was able to throw within, I think he said, like one baseball's width of wherever he put the catcher's mitt. It was going to be, so whatever a baseball is, let's say it's like, I don't know, 3.5 inches, whatever it is, that was how close he would come to hitting the target every time the entire season. So it was amazing that he was able to do that, to throw with the heat and to throw with the command, what we call today command, but back then was called control, to be able to do that for such an extended period of time. But, you know, it's interesting. We wrote a piece recently, Weezy and I wrote a piece recently for ESPN's The Undefeated, and it's a story we touch upon in the book of when King was assassinated, that baseball was one of the few sports. It was right before opening day. Baseball was one of the few sports that didn't stop play to honor King, at least not officially. The commissioner at the time, Eckert, left it up to the teams. And to make a long story shorter, it ended up being the Pirates who really led the charge, saying we're not going to take the field. And then after they did it, other teams fell in line. The Pirates, of course, back then were the most integrated team in the league. So there was still that kind of, this goes back to the question before from Bruce, whether baseball was ahead or behind. You know, in that instance, baseball was behind the other sports. They weren't doing anything. King was assassinated. They were ready to go out and play. Then they said, all right, we'll play. We'll take off the first day, but the second day of the season is the day of the funeral. We'll play that day. Then they got pushed back on that, and they said, all right, well, the West Coast teams, the minute the funeral's over, the West Coast teams can take the field because they'll be playing later in the day after the interment. And eventually the Pirates took the stand. Other teams fell in line, the Astros being one of them, but other teams fell in line. So while baseball was ahead of the curve in some ways, they were behind on other things.
Another pitcher who dominated that year and very different than Bob Gibson was, of course, Denny McClain, who won 31 games for the Tigers. Loved the spotlight, anything he could get out of it. And so many great stories in the book, from his pitching while hungover at the All-Star game to his drinking of 24 Pepsis a day to playing as an organist and then grooving one to Mickey Mantle for home run number 535.
Well, you know what? What was so great about that showdown was that you really had two such opposite guys. Bob Gibson and Denny McClain in the World Series. I mean, Bob Gibson, you know, did not want the spotlight. If anything, he was away from it, was you know, pissed at the what was going on with the assassinations. McLean, on the other hand, is loving the limelight. He is a complete opposite. He's a, you know, a talkative guy. He talks with the media. He loves the media. He sits around for hours with them. He has them over to his house for parties when he's playing the organ. So you have Gibson, a complete athlete, really watching his body and working out. McLean drinking 24 Pepsis a day. So you have two guys who are really opposite, and then they, you know, they come together in the World Series, which is just, you know, it's the stuff that, you know, sports writers dream about, because you have such two strong forces coming together like that. But you mentioned the story of McLean. He had already made 30 games. He's in first place. The Yankees are out of it at this point. And he knows that Mantle wants to catch Jimmy Fox. Everybody's been hanging on this. You know, he needs one more homer to catch Jimmy Fox before he retires. Everybody knows he's going to retire. And McLean tells the catcher, calls out the catcher, says, tell Mantle I'm going to groove one. So he throws one right down. The catcher does it, tells Mantle, and then McLean grooves one. Mantle doesn't swing. He does it again. He throws a second. He grooves it. And he calls the catcher out. He goes, what the hell's going on? He goes, well, Mantle wants to know if you really mean it. He goes, yes, I really mean it. I just threw him two meatballs. So finally he turns to Mantle. He goes, Mick, where do you want it? So Mantle shows him, puts his hand out, like right here, and McLean throws it there. And Mantle, you know, hits his homer and catches Fox. And they interviewed Gibson afterwards, and they said, what do you think of that? And Gibson said, you can respect the guy all you want, but what I would have done is I would have thrown a high, hard one. I'm not going to give in to anybody. And that gives you an idea of the difference between these two guys and how they handle themselves. And, you know, it's both of them are great. It's just fantastic to have watched the two of them go head-to-head.
It's John Florio, author of One Nation Under Baseball, here in the best of downtown on your Sunday morning. Hey, I want to remind you, too, as we roll back into school and the show this week, it's back to another Student of the Week, and we're still looking for more nominations as we close in on the month of May. We love honoring these terrific young people every week on the program. You can nominate a student by shooting an email to us at downtownwithrichkimble@gmail.com. Give us the student's name, their school, year of graduation, and just a couple of sentences talking about what they do in the classroom, in school activities, and the community that set them apart. It's one of the best things we do on the program. Weekly winners get a free large pizza from Angelo's Pizzeria in Bangor and Hamden, and all those winners qualify for the Downtown Student of the Year Scholarship that will be presenting in June, thanks to our friends at Angelo's and our partners at WABI TV5. So send in those Student of the Week nominations. Again, it's downtownwithrichkimble@gmail.com. And we'll honor another weekly winner coming up this Friday on the show. Lots of good stuff this week, starting with Monday. Our usual suspects, and Nick Durbel will be here talking about Maine baseball. Mike Lowe, the Portland Press Herald. You know who won't be with us tomorrow?
Who's that?
That will be Alan Adams. He's on the road to New York for his Jeopardy interview to see if he can get himself on the show.
Wishing him all the luck in that one.
Yeah, and I believe the deal is that we get like 10% of his winnings.
I'm pretty sure that's the standard contract, yes.
Look, that you get on Jeopardy, that's maybe the ultimate downtown bump. I mean, we've had people win Emmys and Grammys and Oscars and stuff like that, but you get on Jeopardy, boom. But again, Alan did win the rap battle, so that's more than anything I've accomplished in life.
And if he absolutely refuses to give us the 10%, the payment will be getting Trebek on the show.
Yes. Yeah. I think during a taping, you just hand him your cell phone.
Yeah, talk to these guys.
Although, you know, my greatest fear would be I would get on the phone, I would start talking like Sean Connery, like it was the SNL sketch. But we'd take that either way. Anyway, that's going to wrap it up for us. Thanks to everybody on the show this morning, authors John Florio and Mark Kurlansky, and, of course, David Roth of Deadspin. Have a wonderful rest of your weekend. We'll catch you tomorrow afternoon at downtown 4 o'clock right here on Z62 Retro Radio and in high definition, WKIT HD3. You're going to be